What I'd like to do in these three lectures, not by any means, as Jerry indicated, do I plan to cover the history of the Churches of Christ. I don't know the full history of the Churches of Christ. In fact, you know, it's taken me a long time on this project because there is so much to read. And believe it or not, I've been on it for 3 years and I'm still in the 19th century. So I've, you know, as you can tell, I've got a long way to go. But I will get it done and we will get the book out eventually. But what I'd like to do today is talk some about the early years of the Churches of Christ and the backgrounds to the Churches of Christ. I remember when I was quite young, growing up in West Texas in San Angelo, and I used to wonder as a kid, obviously I had learned of the importance of the church and the connections of the church to the New Testament. And I used to wonder, where was the church in all those centuries between Pentecost in the 19th century or Pentecost in the 20th century? And I don't know that I have very many answers to that question, but I do want to share with you in these lectures some backgrounds that I hope you'll find interesting. The first lecture I've called Churches of Christ, Children of the Puritans. In the second lecture I'm calling, this is tomorrow, Churches of Christ, Children of the Frontier. In the third lecture, I want to call Churches of Christ, Proponents of Rational Christianity. So that's where we're headed. Now, let me begin by saying that Churches of Christ have two histories. The first history is what I would call our sacred history. And that history is our connection with the New Testament. To the extent that we hold fast in the Apostles' doctrine, we tie in with the New Testament tradition, and obviously the New Testament and the primitive church is part of our history. But that's the part of our history to which we normally attend, our sacred history. But the other part of the history is that part of the history to which we normally don't attend, and that's the part that I want to call our profane history. In other words, our history since Pentecost, our history in time, our history in the intervening centuries between Pentecost and the 19th and the 20th centuries. Now, I want to say to begin with that what defines Churches of Christ more than any other theme and has for 150 years is our allegiance to what we call restoration of primitive Christianity. Is that a fair statement? I think this is the central motif of Churches of Christ, restoration of primitive Christianity. And if this is the central theme of Churches of Christ, then if we want to trace out the history of Churches of Christ, then I think what we want to do is to trace the development of this theme. And from that point of view, from that perspective, I think that we could safely say that Churches of Christ in this sense, and I underscore in this sense, Churches of Christ in this sense have at least some origins in 1519 in Zurich, Switzerland. Now, you'll recognize 1519 as right in the center of the Protestant Reformation. And as a matter of fact, the entire Protestant Reformation was devoted in one way or another to restoring primitive Christianity. The whole Protestant Reformation was devoted to this. But you find in the Protestant Reformation at least three different styles of restoring primitive Christianity. At least three different styles. One style was represented by Martin Luther. Now, Luther clearly was a restorationist. What was it that Luther wanted to restore? Luther was anxious to restore what he viewed as the word of grace, the gospel, forgiveness of sins, justification by grace through faith, simultaneously justifying and a sinner. This is Luther's restoration. So Luther turns out to focus on Romans and Galatians and these wonderful books in the New Testament that talk about salvation from sin and redemption, the restoration of the gospel. The radicals of the Reformation, those Anabaptists, the forebearers of the people we know today as the Mennonites and the Amish, the radicals of the Reformation also were restorationists and talked a lot about the idea of restoration, used the term restitution, restitutio in the Latin. What was it those Anabaptists wanted to restore? Not so much the gospel of faith and grace as with Luther. But for those Anabaptists, their concern was to restore the lifestyle of the primitive Christians, the commitment, the servanthood, the willingness even to suffer martyrdom, if need be, for the sake of the cross. And thousands of Anabaptists went to their death for their faith in Europe in the 16th century. And as I said, their descendants today are the Mennonites and the Amish. But then in Europe, there was yet a third wing of the Reformation and a third style of restoration. And this third style of restoration was earliest represented by Huldreich Zwingli, the great reformer in Zurich, Switzerland, who came there in 1519 as people's priest of the great minster. Zwingli's concern was not so much, as with Luther, to restore the gospel of faith and grace, nor was Zwingli's concern so much as with the Anabaptists to restore the lifestyle and the commitment and the sense of discipleship in a very practical way that characterized the primitive Christians. But Zwingli's concern was, to a very large extent, to restore the forms and the structures of the primitive church, worship, church organization, patterns. Zwingli's successor, Heinrich Bullinger, who became people's priest in the great minster after Zwingli was killed fighting the Roman Catholics on the field of battle. They used to do that in those days, you know. Heinrich Bullinger succeeded Zwingli as people's priest in Zurich, and Heinrich Bullinger wrote in his History of the Reformation, "The organs in the churches are not a particularly old institution in these parts, since they do not agree with the apostolic teaching. The organs in the great minster were broken up in the 9th of December in 1527. For from this time forth, neither singing nor organs in the churches was wanted." Neither singing nor organs. Why not singing? What does the book say? Sing and make melody. Where? In your heart, you see? So they didn't sing and they didn't play. But this wing of the Protestant Reformation is the wing that we call the Reformed wing of the Protestant Reformation, probably best represented by John Calvin. But I want to focus today more on Zwingli and Bullinger than on John Calvin. Now, I'm going to cover a lot of ground very quickly today, so you're going to have to really stay with me, and that's why I didn't think I needed a blackboard. I wrote to Jerry and I said, I don't need a thing. But about 20 minutes ago, it occurred to me, I've got so much to say that I better put some of this on the board. Otherwise, we may all get hopelessly confused. But I'll try to keep it straight and orderly and systematic as we go through. Now, the next point that I want to make is that while Heinrich Bullinger was the people's priest at the great minster in Zurich, Switzerland, this idea of restoration of forms and structures makes its way to England and informs the English Reformation. And this happens during the reign of Edward VI, 1547 to 1553. Now, it's important that Luther, with his idea of restoration of the gospel, faith and grace, never really impacted the English Reform. Never profoundly impacted the English Reform. The Anabaptists, with their notion of the restoration of primitive discipleship and a primitive lifestyle, obviously never impacted the English Reform. They never impacted much of any kind of reform except their own, as we know. And even today, they're quite separate from the mainstream culture. But the tradition that did impact the English Reform was this Zwinglian Bullinger tradition out of Zurich, and it happened in the reign of Edward VI between 1547 and 1553. Now, when the idea of the restoration of the church, form, structures, organization, worship, ceremonies, and so on, makes its way to England during the reign of Edward VI, what kind of a milieu exists in England as a receptacle for this idea? What kind of a backdrop is in England in which to receive this theme? The receptacle for that idea had been stated earlier than Edward VI by William Tyndale. Do you remember William Tyndale, the great biblical translator, the man who first put the New Testament into the English tongue, the full New Testament, published in the 1526 and the second edition in 1534. Tyndale did his work during the reign, and I'm putting these monarchs on the board because this is a handy and systematic way to keep all this straight, I think. During the reign of Henry VIII, 1509 to 1547. Now Tyndale, very briefly, Tyndale, during his work as a biblical translator, especially when he was translating the Old Testament, was struck with the theme of Israel as the chosen people standing in a covenant relationship with God. That theme struck him in a very peculiar kind of way. But he was also struck with a theme as he worked through the Old Testament material that Israel, while she may once have been clearly God's chosen people, failed in her covenant duties, and God turned his back on Israel, so Tyndale said, and turned to the Christian church. But Tyndale went on to say, the Christian church has also turned her back on covenant duties when she developed Roman Catholic ceremonies and traditions and elaborate rituals and so on and so forth. And now God has chosen yet another people as his own to be the bearer of the covenant. And guess who the new chosen people is, according to William Tyndale? Steve? England. He remembers. 11 years and he still remembers. Wonderful. You're a good man. See how stale my lectures are? England. England emerges as God's chosen people in the thought of Tyndale. But this is this. You just cannot escape this point if you want to talk about the backgrounds to restoration. It's just central. Now, in the second edition of the New Testament, which Tyndale published in 1534 in English, Tyndale wrote in prologues and prefaces to that New Testament that the way, dear Christian reader, by which you must understand the New Testament is to ascertain and understand and appreciate the theme of covenant. God has a covenant with his people, and we must keep the covenant because we are God's chosen people. And if we fail to keep the covenant, God will curse us as he cursed Israel of old. But if we keep the covenant, God will bless us as he blessed Israel of old. But Tyndale never spelled out what it meant to keep the covenant. Now, you see, all this was in the reign of Henry VIII. Then old Henry dies and Edward VI comes to the throne. And under the reign of Edward VI, Heinrich Bullinger begins to influence the English. And Bullinger begins to say, ah, dear English, the way to keep the covenant is to restore the primitive church in its forms and its structures and its ceremonies and its worship and its organization. This is what covenant keeping means. And so under Edward VI, the Church of England, which had been established, as you know, by Henry VIII, the Church of England undertook an effort to do this, to some degree, to return to primitive Christianity. But they didn't do a great deal. And when Edward died, In 1553, you probably remember, if you remember your history lessons very well, Edward was a young lad when he took the throne, 10 years old or 9 years old. He was sick and frail. He died after just a few years on the throne and was succeeded on the throne by Mary. You remember Mary? Bloody Mary, they called her, who reigned from 53 to 58. And Mary's great overriding interest was to return England to the Roman Catholic faith, not to restore the primitive church. In fact, she wanted to erase this aspect from the English heritage and return England to the Holy Roman Church. And so Mary thought she could accomplish this by burning at the stake those leaders of the Protestant Reformation in England. So she set about doing this. And this is a very important development for the story I want to tell. Because while Mary was arresting Protestants and taking them off to Smithfield and burning them at the stake, a lot of Protestants in England knew that their turn might come next. You never know when in the middle of the night there might come a knock at the door. Come with me. And you're off to Smithfield to burn at the stake for your faith. And so that left these people with just a handful of options. One option would be to continue to practice their Protestant faith and run the risk of being arrested and killed. One option would be to go underground and live in obscurity, maybe for the rest of your life, depending on how long this woman reigns on the throne. And a third option would be to flee England and go abroad in exile. And the third option is what a lot of English Protestants take. They decide to flee England, and they leave and go into self-imposed exile. Now, these people are very important for this story, and they're called the Marian Exiles. The Marian Exiles. And when they get into exile in Geneva, Basel, Frankfurt, Strasbourg, they begin to reflect on the events of the last several months and the last several years. They begin to think about this idea of the covenant, how Tyndale had told them in his New Testament prefaces and prologues that if they kept the covenant, which meant to restore the primitive church as they understand it now, God would bless England, but if they failed to keep the covenant, God would curse England. And then they think about what's been going on for the last several months with all their friends and relatives hailed into custody and taken to Smithfield and burned at the stake. And it's clear to them that God is cursing England. And then they have to ask, for what reason? Why is God cursing England? And it's clear to them that God is cursing England for one reason. And they think to themselves, we had the opportunity under Edward VI to thoroughly restore the primitive church. We had the chance to cleanse the church, to cleanse the sanctuary, to return the English church to those simple, primitive traditions of first century Christianity. But we failed. We temporized. We compromised. We settled for mere reform instead of a full-blown restoration. And so these people begin to plan how, when Mary dies, they will return to England and totally restructure the English church, dismantle the Church of England, the Archbishop of Canterbury, the vestments, kneeling at the name of Jesus, all the symbols, all this will go, and the Church of England will be returned to primitive apostolic simplicity, and then God will bless England. And these people turn out to be the earliest Puritans. These are the earliest Puritans. And I am more and more convinced, and especially in the last 3 or 4 weeks, and I'll tell you in a few minutes why I say the last 3 or 4 weeks, the Churches of Christ in America in 1984, 1985, stand squarely in the Puritan heritage. And I'll come to this in a few minutes and explain why. But these are the earliest Puritans. Now, to make a long story short, Mary dies, the Puritans return to England, they set about dismantling the Church of England, restoring the primitive church as well as they can. But they don't get very far because Queen Elizabeth does not support them. She throws roadblocks in their way at every step. They can preach. They can write pamphlets. They can lecture. They can propagandize. But that's all they can do because they don't have the authority of the crown on their side. Elizabeth never persecutes them. She just throws roadblocks in their way. And then Elizabeth dies in 1603, and James the First becomes King of England. James the First also doesn't severely persecute the Puritans. He doesn't kill them. He doesn't maim them. But he, how could we say it? Goes out of his way to annoy them. For example, the Puritans love to preach, and the way they can return England to primitive Christianity is through the pulpit, through persuasion. And so on any given Sunday in a Puritan parish, the people go to church and listen to the sermon for 3 hours. And then the Puritans expect their people to go home and in the afternoons to spend the day thinking about the sermon and reflecting on it and making it a part of their consciousness. And so in 1618, King James I issues the Book of Sports. And in the Book of Sports, he says, "I, the king, hereby command all English people, after attending worship on Sunday, to go home, and the rest of the day is sports day. And you should run races and have games and maypoles and cockfights and so on." And of course, the whole point was to take away from the Puritans their Sabbath, their means of persuading the people of the rightness of primitive Christianity. Now, we're getting very close to the earliest settlements, earliest Puritan settlements in New England. You know, this is 1618. If you remember, the Puritans came to Plymouth in 1620. And they settled Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1630, and this was 1618. Now in 1625, James died, and he was succeeded on the throne by Charles I. And this is so important also to the story, because Charles I could not have been more diametrically opposed to what the Puritans were trying to do. In fact, Charles I was Roman Catholic in his own persuasion and orientation, married a Roman Catholic princess from France, Henrietta Maria, built a Roman Catholic chapel in the heart of London, replete with Roman Catholic ceremonies. And while he was king, the Church of England, far from returning to primitive practices and apostolic simplicity, the Church of England launched a program of an ever more elaborate ceremonies, richly textured liturgy, increasingly so throughout the reign of Charles. And Charles even took steps to arrest some Puritans, cut off their ears, slit their noses, imprison them, kill them. Charles made things very difficult on the Puritans. Now remember, he came to the throne in 1625, and when did I say the Bay Colony was established? 1630. Now why did the Puritans leave England and come to America? I've been reading a manuscript for the last, I've been reading along at it for the last 2 or 3 weeks, and I've just finished it and taking copious notes on it. It's a manuscript for a book that will be published by a professor at the University of Iowa by the name of Dwight Bozeman. And it's got to be one of the most important pieces of work for understanding our own history that I've ever come across. The title of the book will be, when it's published, I've only read it in manuscript form, the title will be Live Ancient Lives, colon. And then the subtitle is something like, I don't remember precisely, something like Primitive or Apostolic Christianity Among the New England Puritans. And what he argues in this book, something that I have sensed for a long time, but I have never been able to document it, but he has documented it copiously so that no one can read this book, I think, and fail to be persuaded of his case. And the point that he makes is that central to what the New England Puritans was all about, fundamental, at the very heart and soul of the New England Puritans, was their absolute dedication to return to primitive apostolic Christianity. In fact, I'd like to read to you, if I could, a quotation from John Robinson, who was the preacher for the Leyden Pilgrims who left Leyden and came to Plymouth in 1620. Now listen to this quotation from John Robinson. You tell me if this could come from Alexander Campbell or Barton Stone. "We do believe by the word of God that the things we teach are not new." Not new, you see, not new fashioned or fashionable, but old truths renewed. "So are we not less persuaded that the church constitution in which we are set is cast in the apostolical and primitive mold, and not one day or one hour younger in the nature and form of it than the first church of the New Testament." How could it be more clear? Now, Bozeman, I want to share with you now some things I've learned from Bozeman. Bozeman takes as his point of departure the way so many historians for, I don't know how long, it seems like forever, have interpreted New England Puritanism. Now, it's amazing to me, it just is amazing to me that a theme as central as the restoration of primitive Christianity among the New England Puritans can go for so long and be unnoticed by historians of Puritanism. Why do you think that would be true? Why do you think historians in our modern period could read this literature and say all kinds of things about the Puritans? They earned into the wilderness. They came into the wilderness to shine the light to Europe and revitalize the world and lead the world into a great millennium, and so on and so forth, which is the standard explanation, but never a word about returning to primitive Christianity. How could they miss it? Have any ideas? I have a thought on it. I'll tell you why I think historians miss it. It's because returning to primitive Christianity, the whole idea of return, really stands at variance with the whole thrust of the modern world. I mean, we're not trained in our modern world to even understand the idea of return. We're trained to understand the idea of progress, right? Onward, upward, moving onward. And so Perry Miller, the great historian of Puritans several years ago, talked about the errand into the wilderness and the city on the hill that would shine the light into the world and enlighten the world and lead on into the grand and glorious millennium, progress. But he missed the theme of returning backwards. He didn't altogether miss it, but he certainly didn't sense the centrality of it. Now, Bozeman, I want to give you a couple of quotes from Bozeman. I'm not going to bore you to death with quotations, but two quotations from Bozeman himself are very important. In the first place, he says, "You understand what the Puritans were all about when you begin to key on their key terms." What were the terms they used? What were their code words? Well, now, we have code language in the Churches of Christ, don't we? What are some of our code words? Huh? Well, we use terms like the brotherhood, right? That's a code word. When we say, I mean, we all understand what that means. Outsiders might not, but we do. What about the idea of human inventions? We ever use that term? Human inventions? Novelties of men? the inventions of man as opposed to Scripture. A cardinal theme of the Puritan movement, but virtually ignored in the scholarly literature, was a vigorous protest against human invention. Now listen to this. That which men's brain has devised. Few solid bursts of Puritan complaint were complete without this theme. Constantly, you see, the protest against human inventions. And so, over and over again, the Puritans pointed the way back to the days of the apostles. Now, I have so many quotations here, and I'm not going to bore you by reading quotations from the Puritans. I can make my point in my own words, I think. But I need to communicate to you something about the genius of this Restoration ideal among the New England Puritans, because in one sense, it's very different from our understanding. Remember, the Puritans thought of themselves as the new Israel, chosen people. God had chosen England, but they were convinced God had deserted England. The English had faulted their covenant, and now God, as it were, had left England and come across the Atlantic Ocean with the Puritans and no longer dwelt in London, but now dwells in Boston or New Haven. Now, the Puritans almost had this conception. They were the chosen people. God had come with them. God would bless them if they kept the covenant and curse them if they failed. And when the Puritans thought about restoration and primitive Christianity and the primitive ordinances in the ancient church, they looked not just to the New Testament, but also to the Old Testament. They didn't make this clear distinction the way Alexander Campbell was later to make it. And furthermore, the whole Bible was the pattern not just for worship, for organization of the church, for church polity, for church organization, and so on, but the whole Bible also was the pattern for every aspect of the life in New England. The government, how the government should be framed. It's an amazing thing. I read through Bozeman's manuscript, and I said it now, I can't believe this. I know this is true, but it's just, as you read it, you think, this is just almost more than one can believe. They're going to frame their government. Now, if we're going to frame a government, what do we do in our modern age? We consider all sorts of pragmatic aspects, and we think about what it is that we're doing, and we're very pragmatic as we go about it. Not the Puritans. They go to the text. How did Israel frame her government? And the way Israel framed her government is the way we frame our government. If we are to punish people for capital crimes, what kinds of penalties do we impose? We go to the Old Testament text. Read an interesting story in Bozeman's manuscript about a man who was involved in a perverse act with a cow. This was in 1636, and the Puritans had been there for 6 years, and they didn't have any laws to regulate this at this point. And they didn't quite know what to do, and so, obviously, what do? They go to the Old Testament. And what was done in such a case? Why, the man is to be taken and is to be hung, but before he's hung, the cow is slain before his eyes, and then he's hung. And this is what happens to that poor man in 1636 who was witnessed, as the report goes, by a resident of Salem.
Before they launch wars with the Indians or wars with the French, they go to the Old Testament. How did the children of Israel conceive their wars? Now, now let me get this thing back on, and then we'll talk about it. If you want to talk about example, now in our hermeneutic in Churches of Christ, we often say that we go by command, example, and what? And necessary inference. You find the same hermeneutic among the Puritans. Command, example, and necessary inference. They made it very clear that God's commands are always to be followed, but God's commands are not limited to those explicit commands, but commands are to be perceived where there are examples and where there are deductions or reasonable inferences drawn from the text. And where you find this idea of example and inference operative especially is when the Puritans are looking to the Old Testament as a model for setting up the state, because obviously the situation is so different from the situation in ancient Israel. So it's not a one-on-one correspondence. But nonetheless, they search all the relevant texts, and then they draw their conclusions, and then they do what they do based on this primitive model. So the ancient ways, the ancient patterns, the ancient examples of biblical times are normative in every instance for the Puritans. Now, I do want to share with you two things in particular that I think you'll find interesting. You know, every school child learned something about the Puritans coming into the American wilderness. Why did the Puritans come to the American wilderness? Well, for freedom's sake, we say. Or they came here, we say, to practice their religion. Or Perry Miller might say they came here to, in an errand to the wilderness, to shine the light back to Europe and usher in the millennial age, and so on and so forth. But when you read from the Puritans themselves why they came to America, you find they came here for one reason only: to restore the primitive church. Now remember, Massachusetts Bay Colony, 1630, Charles is on the throne, what's going on in England, this effort to institute in the Church of England an elaborate liturgy and rich ceremonies and grand rituals with color and pageantry in the churches. And this is simply more than the Puritans can take. And they're convinced that because of these policies of the English church, God will surely break out in wrath against England. And they don't want to be there when that happens. And furthermore, they want to be free not just to practice their religion. It's more than that. They want to be free to restore the primitive church. "We believe," said John Cotton. You remember John Cotton, don't you? One of the first leaders in Massachusetts Bay Colony. "We believe that there is a vast difference between men's inventions and God's institutions. We fled from men's inventions." We fled from men's inventions. On another occasion, Cotton said that the body of the members in the first church in Boston do in general profess the reason of their coming over to us was that they might be freed from the bondage of human inventions. Over and again, the Puritans say why they came to America: to be free from the bondage of human inventions. One preacher told his flock, "You have left your trades, your friends, your country, and you have put yourself upon a changeable and hazardous journey because your consciences could not submit to ceremonies." Another preacher said, "The end of our coming hither was a reformation of what was amiss in the churches we came from which we made a secession into this wilderness with true desires after a full reformation according to God's word. And on and on and on it goes. Why did they come here? To escape men's inventions, to restore primitive Christianity. Now, another thing in which I think you may have an interest, we all know that the first book that was published in America was what? Maybe we all don't know. The Bay Psalm Book. You remember this? The Bay Psalm Book. The first book, I think that's correct, or maybe it's just one of the first. But at any rate, very famous hymnal of New England Puritans. I keep getting this thing twisted around my leg. There's an interesting story behind the Bay Psalm Book. The preface to the Bay Psalm Book tells the story. The Puritans brought a hymn book with them, but that hymn book had psalms in it, but the psalms were far from primitive, because in the effort to set the psalms to metrics, those who set them to metrics lost the authentic, primitive rendering of the psalms. And how could people who want to stand in the primitive way sing psalms that don't conform to the original primitive psalms? And furthermore, the book that they brought with them had hymns of human invention in it. And how can people determined to follow in the primitive way sing hymns of men's brains and human wit and men's devices? And so a team of Puritans set to work to produce the Bay Psalm Book. And the preface tells what they attempted to do, to produce a song book that would be as close as possible to the psalms that were sung as you find them in the Psalms of David. No hymns of men's invention. No songs of human wit, but primitive psalms of David. And that's the story behind the Bay Psalm Book. Now, here's the point that I want to make next. Churches of Christ, it seems to me, perhaps more than any other group in America. Now, that's quite a statement, I know. But it seems to me that churches of Christ, maybe more than any other group in America, stand squarely in the Puritan tradition. Did you hear what I said? Churches of Christ stand in the Puritan tradition. Now, that has all kinds of implications. One of the implications is, you know, we have been so, I don't know, sometimes apologetic for our faith sometimes. And back in the old days when we used to live on the wrong side of the tracks and our buildings were little whitewashed buildings on the wrong side of town. You remember this. Some of you remember this. We used to be kind of apologetic and so on. You know, strictly in terms of culture and history, we are squarely in that great Puritan tradition. Now, how so? How so? Well, let me very quickly explain this. The first generation of Puritans, I want to very quickly, in the time I have left, tell a story that takes us from the first generation of Puritans to Barton Stone in the 19th century. And I think there's a direct connection, and here's the way it works. The first generation of Puritans were committed to the restoration of the primitive church. But with the second generation, the zeal cooled. This is not unusual in any religious movement. It's happened in our own movement. You know, what is so central to the thinking of the first generation is less so for the second generation and even less so for the third. And by the time you get to 1660 and 1670, the truly devout Puritans, and there are fewer and fewer now, are very concerned because the Puritan churches are slipping from their original zeal, and the concern to restore primitive Christianity is increasingly slipping away from their grasp. And the last part of the 17th century is a period we call the Jeremiad tradition. The Jeremiad tradition, after the prophet Jeremiah. What did Jeremiah do with regard to Israel? He wept He lamented. He wailed and he cried for the sins of his people, because God would surely destroy Jerusalem if Jerusalem didn't turn. And this is what the Puritan preachers now are saying. We've departed from the faith of the fathers. We're no longer characterized by that early zeal. We no longer pray as we once did. We no longer read the scriptures we once did. We've left the traditions of the primitive church. We're developing human inventions and traditions of men's wit instead of traditions of the apostolic way. But these Puritan preachers in the Jeremiah tradition, increasingly, instead of holding up the New Testament and the primitive churches as the model, increasingly held up as the model to be emulated, guess who? The first generation of the Puritans. See, the first generation of the Puritans had it together. And so if we want to be faithful, we need to return to the days of our forefathers. Does that sound familiar? Do we ever do this? You know, are we ever caught in this thing, and instead of returning to Paul and Peter, you're going to go back to Camel and Stone and Lipscomb and Fanning? You know, we get this sometimes, don't we? Well, this is what the third and fourth generation Puritan preachers are doing, holding up John Cotton, to William Bradford, Cotton Mather, and so on. These were the guys who restored primitive Christianity, and if we want to be right, we've got to recover the days of the fathers. Well, then we come into the 18th century, and in the 1740s, there's a great outbreak of revival activity, which we know as the Great Awakening. And in the midst of the Great Awakening, there are still some people who say, we need to go back to the days of the Puritan fathers. Still looking back to the Puritan fathers. And the people who do this in the days of the Great Awakening separate from that great body of Puritans, because the great body of Puritans now has moved considerably further away. They separate from the great body of Puritans. They want to talk about getting back to the days of the fathers, and they're called the separatists. They're simply separatists because they've separated out from the great body of Puritans. From the ranks of the separatists in New England during the period of the Great Awakening emerges a group of separate Baptists. Separate Baptists. Separatists who take the next logical step. They go, instead of back to the days of the Puritan fathers, they go once again all the way back to the primitive church as a model and adopt immersion of adults as a symbol of their commitment to the authenticity of the primitive faith, the separate Baptists. Directly out of the ranks of the Puritans, through the separatists, now become the separate Baptists. Now all this is in New England in the 1740s and the 1750s. Then these separate Baptists leave New England and migrate en masse south under the leadership of a man we should know, because I think is very important to our own history, a man by the name of Schubel Starnes, S-T-E-A-R-N-S. S-T-E-A-R-N-S, Schubel Starnes. Separate Baptists in the 1750s migrate from New England down the coast and settle near the border of North Carolina and Virginia. And in the South, in the Carolinas and Virginia, they grow and they preach primitive Christianity. You see, these people have an organic connection with those original Puritans. Have I made that point? They're organically related with the original Puritans. They preach primitive Christianity. They don't preach Puritan fathers. They preach New Testament. They preach foot washing. They preach the kiss of charity. They preach the love feast. You know, they preach all the New Testament ordinances they can find. They preach immersion. There are some things they don't preach. But boy, they really have a vision of New Testament Christianity. And then in the latter part of the 18th century, the separate Baptists join the great westward migration. See, they're already in the South, Carolina and Virginia. They join the great westward migration and they migrate west, and many thousands of separate Baptists settle in Kentucky. In Kentucky. Now remember, these are people who have an organic connection with the New England Puritans who held so strongly to the Restoration ideal. Now these people settle in Kentucky and they win converts in great numbers. Then in 1803, There was a man in Kentucky by the name of Barton Stone, and I think you know this story, how Stone broke from the Presbyterian Church. He and his colleagues organized the Springfield Presbytery, then dissolved the Springfield Presbytery as a, quote, invention of men, claimed to be Christians only, to practice primitive Christianity as a way of uniting all Christians. And Stone began to preach his message of primitive Christianity, renouncing the inventions of men, the traditions of men's wits, returning to primitive Christianity as a way of uniting all Christians. And upon whose ears did that message fall? The ears of the separate Baptists. And the separate Baptists heard, and what they heard was nothing new. They had believed this all their lives. Stone had some insights that they didn't have, but they had believed basically what Stone was preaching all their lives. Stone said, "Now you separate Baptists, there's one thing that's wrong with you. Now you're on the right track, but why be separate Baptists? Let's just be Christians." And so the separate Baptists said, "Why, this guy's right. You know, we've been saying this all our lives." And so they quit being separate Baptists. And guess who came into the Stone movement by the hundreds and the thousands? Separate Baptists. You see, and the point I want to make is that the Stone movement probably would never have grown the way it grew in Kentucky in the first decade of the 19th century had it not been for all those separate Baptists in Kentucky who already believed that. But where did they come from? From Carolina and Virginia, whose forefathers came from New England, whose forefathers came from the separates, whose forefathers came out of the ranks of the Puritans, who came from England, who came from Zurich. And that's why I said that if you want to trace our profane history, I think there's a real sense in which we could argue that a great deal of our heritage does have its roots in Zurich, Switzerland, in 1519, the Protestant Reformation. From there finds its way to England, into the hearts of the Puritans, to New England, into the separates, into the separate Baptists, into the South, over to Kentucky, and into the Stone Movement. And here we are today. We, friends, are in a profound sense descendants of the Puritans. And I don't know any religious body in America today who is any more so. I don't know if that's a plus or a minus, depends on how you view the Puritans. But we stand in their lineage, and we owe them a profound debt. Well, my time is gone, and I do want to give time for questions in the next two sessions. I'm going to try not to be so long-winded. But tomorrow I want us to talk about Churches of Christ, Children of the Frontier, and I want to talk especially about the Stone Movement. And then Friday, Churches of Christ, Proponents of Rational Christianity, and I want us to talk about what Campbell does to the Stone Movement. And I hope you'll get some insights from this that may be somewhat new and fresh. Thanks for coming.